Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk, a podcast where we feature individuals and organizations in and around Oakland Chinatown who are working hard to bring our API and Black communities together. By highlighting their stories, we hope to encourage inclusive, intergenerational, and anti-racist perspectives in all spaces. I'm Akemi Chanimai, the program manager at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center, and this is Let's Talk. Today, we will hear from Pallavi Sharma and Tomei Neil Madison, two visual artists in the Bay Area who have collaborated to present cross-cultural exhibitions featuring Black and Asian artists. Hear how they use visual mediums to explore solidarity, cross-racial advocacy, and resistance. Please note that this episode features a companion slideshow of Pallavi and Tomei's artworks. You can visit this slideshow on OACC's website at oacc.cc. Joining as their facilitator is Pamela Ibanez, OACC's facilities coordinator, who is also a visual artist herself.
Well, thank you so much for joining in this talk with Pallavi and Tomei. I thought we'd just start off with introductions.
Pallavi, why don't you go first?
Okay, yeah, sure. Thank you so much, Tomei, Pam, and Akemi, Jade, for having me. My name is Pallavi Sharma. I'm a practicing artist, curator, and educator. I teach at California College of the Arts in Critical Ethnic Studies program. I have lived in San Ramon, California for the last 18 years. From last two decades, I have been making art on the topic that speak about my experiences as an immigrant, cultural identity, memory, and loss. And I am founder and director of a nonprofit organization, Inner Eye Arts, which is in San Ramon, California.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everyone else. And I also am a visual artist. I have been doing that for quite some time. Sometimes people ask me, how long have I been doing my art? I have to say that my mom reminded me that I actually started at 6 years old, which I don't remember. And that I was very much given a watercolor set as my first gift when I was 6 years old because I was so good. So I'm quite sure I was one of those precocious children that people hated because of that. It's just one of those things. You can't be knowing what you want to do in life so early in age and stick to it. A lot of people don't have that capacity or gift to be able to do that, their journey that way. And I have been involved in various aspects of the arts. I'm a mentor and I teach. My oldest student is 81 years old. He just had a birthday and he turned 82. He has dementia, so it's a very challenging situation of me just now giving him kind of a strokes so that he stays involved in his art. And it's been proven that visual art does help with when people have dementia. So that's been a very good thing for me as I get older to understand what those kinds of things can affect. The political aspect that we're going to be talking about is very important to me because at a point in my life, instead of just doing lovely paintings, I decided that our situation as a human race was being challenged too much, and I switched into doing things that are more applicable to people being what they now want to call woke, which is a very interesting terminology, I find.
Thanks, Tomei and Pallavi.
You're welcome.
So I'll just do a real quick introduction myself. I'm Pamela Ibanez. I'm new to the Oakland Asian Cultural Center as the Facilities and Rentals Coordinator. I've been in Oakland since 2007, and I'm a practicing artist. I struggle to keep making art, but it does somehow keep going. And I feel really blessed to have the history that I have in the Bay Area in the arts. I've worked with Pallavi in the past, and I'm super excited to work, you know, to get to know Tomei more. I was very curious, you know, as an Asian, I'm a Filipina that was born outside of the U.S., and I've been in, like, my favorite thing, like, why I chose the Bay Area to live in was because of its diversity, and so I'm very curious about the history between like how Pallavi and Tomei met each other, and if you guys could talk about that.
I'm a first generation immigrant from India. When I moved to San Francisco Bay Area in, I think, 2001, I immediately started looking for like-minded people, creative people. And it was at this time that I joined a few art organizations. I became a member of National Pen Women Bay Area chapter, which included a group of very accomplished women artists and writers. I met Tome there and immediately became friends with her. We were a part of several art shows together at that time. In her company, I have learned a lot about America, being an immigrant, first generation immigrant, about her lived experiences of the time, even before when I was born. She also curated one of my solo shows in the past. It was titled Traveling Tale in Oakland. And then after that, I got busy with my life, learning, raising two boys with my art practice. But when pandemic hit and I was conceiving the second iteration of my curatorial project, Dhyakar Seeded in Love, which centered around radical power of love and Asian American solidarity, I reached out to Tome again. I reconnected with her and invited her to be my collaborator. I have gained so much in her loving company. Thank you so much, Tome, for everything I have learned from you and your kindness and humanity which you carry with you.
Thank you, Pallavi. Yeah, it's a mutual. As Pallavi said, we did meet at the Bay Area branch of the National League of American Pen Women. And unfortunately, typically, not too many people, women of color, are in the branch. And I think it's a natural thing that people kind of gravitate towards people who are somewhat like themselves. So that was a very much definitive thing that I did when I saw Pallavi. And she, as she said, she's probably perhaps two decades younger than I am, maybe three. and just looking at a younger woman who was so involved in wanting to learn more about American culture. And I had no idea she was first generation immigrant here, because my family has been here for a while and their family and so on and so forth. But I think that what really, more so than just being a person of color, was just she is so enthusiastic about everything. And I just gravitate towards people who are so involved and so wanting to learn so much about what's going on, and not just doing lip service, but actually getting in there and getting involved. And as she said, she's done a number of shows, and I also curate shows. And so we've kind of been back and forth with each other and curating a show that she may be in, a show that I've done, and I may be in a show that she's done. But her work I find is so insightful and fantastic. She does installation artwork, and it's really a must-see. Anytime you see her name associated with a show that she's showing her artwork, people should go to it.
I would love to hear more about the work that you two do.
I'm very much into portraiture because I find it fascinating to look at people and realize that we talk about billions and billions and billions of people, and yet none of us look exactly alike, not even twins. Mm-hmm. And I just recently stopped teaching youngsters. I've been teaching youngsters for forever. And I actually was employed with the city of Oakland as a visual artist for 18 years. And it was primarily for youth and adults and at Studio One Art Center in Oakland. And one of the things that I found very fascinating was when I retired from there, I was also teaching at a community center, and we had twin boys that were about 8 or 9 years old. And kids being kids, as I said, when I was precocious, I don't remember it, but I'm quite sure I got picked on. And so these kids, these two boys, they're sweet, they're cute, the whole package, but kids invariably said things trying to figure out which one was which, and sometimes they weren't kind. So I would teach the kids specific things to look for so that they wouldn't do such non-wonderful things to these boys. So I said, you know, don't say, oh, that one has on a blue shirt and that one has on a green shirt. So that must be that one and that must be that one, talking about their names. That the thing to look for is how they look, you know, look at their features, look at what's different about their features. One had a tiny little mole and the kids finally recognized, oh yeah, such and such one has a tiny little mole. Things that you can't change that readily. And so that's the kind of thing that I like to have people be aware of as we develop and see, like, don't just look at the surface. Don't look at what we are wearing and conclude that somebody is whatever because of what they have on, but really get to know people. And I think this whole movement of people being in solidarity and understanding the way that we get to be more humane is to look into people's hearts and heads, not just what they physically present to us. You know, so being a portrait artist has kind of eased me into a very interesting, now it's more about collaboration with people like Pallavi and other people and other groups who are really trying to make sure that we don't just go down the rabbit hole of all the nonsense that's happening. You know, we really need to step back, re-educate ourselves and embrace one another, because basically we all want good things for ourselves and other people.
I'm also curious, like, in terms of the, you also make paintings. I've seen some paintings, and you work in other mediums as well.
Yes, I work in gouache, which is like a thicker watercolor, and also infused glass. What I do is called co-working. You take solid glass that you usually see in church windows, and you take that glass and put it in, cut it up into whatever you would like as far as a design, and put it in a kiln, and you turn on the heat and you decide how long it's going to be in there and how much heat it requires, and then let it cool off, and usually a day later you open it up and you see what you have.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Pallavi, would you like to share about your work?
So also, like, just like Tomesh said, like, you know, I have been working in different art mediums from very early on. I was born in a family. My mom is an artist. She's a theater actor. My father is a printmaker. And we all, the whole family, we were involved in theater from very beginning. So when I came to Bay Area, when I came to US, there was a sense of loss of community. I started thinking more about home, nostalgia, and started thinking what is the meaning of home from very beginning. And there was a dire sense of finding a sense of belonging. And that's why in most of my work, you'll see that there is a collaborative aspect to it, where I collaborate with, you know, my neighborhood people, my community, people who are struggling, people who have stories to tell. In many of my works, you know, I gathered shoes, I gathered stories from, you know, people. I try to learn about their immigration stories and try to create, you know, a community, and where I can have this sense of belonging. I, at the same time, you know, I join different art organizations, different collaborative groups, different collectives. AVA, Asian American Women Artist Association, is one of them. Very early on in coming to Bay Area, I joined AVA. And till date, it's a big part of my everyday life. AVA has a big role in making me who I am today. And also by creating a collaborative work, creating a socially engaged art practice, it was also to create a space for each other where we can love, nourish each other. And the result was very transformative and healing. And same stands for my curatorial work and pedagogy. Love is essential, as we all know, in building humanity. It's crucial to create space for stories to be shared and discussed. Almost 8 years back, I founded Inner Eye Arts. It's a nonprofit art organization in San Ramon, where I live. It works for the visibility of Asian American multidisciplinary artists since 2014. We collaborate with artists, our local community, by curating art shows, performances, lectures, and workshops to create safe space for critical conversation and connections. But I want to make it clear that when I say visibility, I mean it must include complex cities, of what it means to be Asian American and Asian American narratives, which continuously it should dismantle the stereotypes and confront the mainstream perspective, which often project Asian Americans as a monolith and timeless. So with that, intention, I founded Inner Eye Arts, and, we are curating shows and programs which can, dismantle and understand what is otherness and how it perpetuates differences and wedges between communities.
I want to kind of talk now specifically about arts and activism kind of this combined. It's hard for us, I think, as artists to separate our lives out, right? Like things we're passionate about seem to just seep in together. And I wanted to talk about like the Black Lives Matter movement and also the hate crimes that have been going on, and just kind of your relationships with both of those things that are happening simultaneously.
I just wanted to start out with saying that, it's interesting when I talk about referencing and how does one learn what is accurate or truthful or what we're being told. And it's, I think, very important for all of us to not just get involved in social media, which has taken on such a strong hold with a lot of younger people, that you go deeper and look through, even if it has to be books, or if you're going to use the web, to look for something that's more creditable and held up as a reliable source to understand what truly is happening, because we can be misled so easily because of the reliance on so much of what has become popular, and this whole movement of popularity versus reality, or I shouldn't even use the word reality anymore because that's been co-opted. But just the idea of we really need to learn about the basics of what's really going on. So one of the things that was an impetus for me was when I first learned about when the grapes movement, I shouldn't call it a movement, I thought that Cesar Chavez was the main person involved with that whole movement of getting correct amounts of money for the people who are picking grapes, giving them lodging, all the things that we take for granted that we don't even think about when we're buying a bag of grapes. And then when I started reading other information, it turned out that it was a Filipino man who actually started that whole thing. And Larry Itliong, if that's the correct way and I thought, I've never heard of him. And this is the thing that happens with a lot of movements. Someone is raised up to be the voice, the face, the everything about a movement, but then you don't know all the people who are behind and who really started it, who really propelled it, and who put it basically in legislation on the map. So it's one of the key things that helps me to, when I do my projects, even though some of them might seem lightweight as far as the paintings or the glass references, I try to make sure that they have some credibility, that someone will be more engaged in the look of it and go beyond it and say, wow, I wonder why she put that in her painting, and actually look it up and find out information. So that's that. And then there was a reference of Vincent Chin, that in our more recent history, in the 1980s, which is when I moved here in the Bay Area in 1974. So that's pretty current for me, 1982. And if I think about what I was doing in 1982, the one time that I had a job that had nothing to do with art was from 1980 to 1990, when I was working as a receptionist in the law department of PG&E. But I still was doing my art. Like you said, Pamela, sometimes it becomes challenging to get to do your art because you have to do other things. When working at PG&E, which was the only time of 10 years in my lifetime that I had a job that had nothing whatsoever to do with art, but I was able to show my art because PG&E, this is the San Francisco site, the main headquarters of PG&E. I was working as a receptionist in the law department, and it afforded me access to attorneys, which consequently afforded me people who had more discretionary money. So I could show my art and sell it. So that's kind of a byproduct of what we're talking about. But just the idea of how every situation that you're in, if you stay open, you will learn something that actually can enrich your art. And that was a very wonderful thing for me, even though I never expected it, that, lawyers are human beings too, and they had their various approaches to life and their biases and their whatever, and you start to learn about people and how can you persuade people. And visual art is such a great way to persuade people to change their minds. That is one of the best gifts I have ever really believed that God has given me, is the ability to do art and then use it in such a way that it can make people open up and think about different ways that people can interpret things.
Can you give us an example of that, like of how visual art has changed people?
Well, even right now with this thing about COVID and vaccinations, I don't think that it's a great thing for us to divide ourselves as a people, have different camps, as they like to call us, and say that these are vaxxers, these are non-vaxxers, these are people who don't believe in science, these are people who believe in science. Because ultimately, we're all still working on other people's stories, other people's histories. And that word itself, his stories, which has now become questionable. We should not give people a hard time if they think that there's been a manipulation of truth, because we know people don't always tell the truth. With a society that tries to be democratic, which is what we're living in, there is the knowledge of knowing if you tell a people too much that's negative, it's going to disrupt their emotions. People have to hold back on different things. People have to manipulate what they say to you. So ultimately, all that wraps up to say that I have done a couple of images to just say that we just need to be at peace and stop all this division. And for some people, they feel comfortable telling me that they're not going to get a vaccination. Getting the message out is basically what we do. We're tellers. We're visual tellers of story, as opposed to performers or other people that they now lump in and call artists. It's what's needed. We need to understand that I think most people are trying their best to live a life and be in the present, understand the past, use what's useful from the past, and move their life forward in a positive way. And that's mainly where I am.
Pallavi, would you like to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and the anti-Asian hate crimes?
Yes, most definitely. You know, I totally like, as Tomei was saying about her art practice, I totally align with that, that my art practice is also my tool to understand, protest, and align. As I said, that I came to America almost 25 years back with my own set of prejudice, fear, hopes, and dreams. I needed to educate myself, dismantle and decolonize through a set of practices, and still keep checking myself every step of the way so that I don't repeat the same mistakes. This also means that to keep myself open to receive, learn, and also share my own experiences to heal from my own wounds and be loving and kind to oneself. I read somewhere, it was a long time back, that the things you do for the society, you also do it for yourself. And what you do for yourself, you also do it for your society. So during the pandemic, I did two projects, Dhaya Akhar Seeded in Love, which we just talked a little bit about. It was a visual art showcase featuring a work of 12 Asian American and African American artists at Lindsay Duck's Brown Gallery in San Ramon, which was inspired by the writings of medieval Indian saint poet Kabir Das Ji and writings of bell hooks on power of radical love. It created space for people who are on margins, dismantle stereotype prejudice we hold against each other. It included collaborative and participatory art projects by youth in community to curate spaces to talk specifically about issues which impact both Black and Asian people. Along with Dhaya Akhar Seated in Love, I also coordinated a community art banner project last year, which was titled Breathing Free Together by San Ramon Social Justice Collective. This portable art showcase, which is regularly displayed at local schools, justice fairs, and public spaces. It included artworks by residents of San Ramon. It was so heartwarming to see, you know, artworks by a small kid of 5 years old, as well as like 80-year-old grandma talking about what race, equity, and justice means to them. And the whole organization, San Ramon Social Justice Collective, was born inspired by BLM movement and thinking anti-Asian, the hate crimes, which was emerging, rapidly growing at that time. So I think both the projects were a kind of creating a platform to talk about, align myself with BLM, as well as talk about anti-Asian hate crimes and how to create that space where we can, again, understand the complexities of the problem and not to avoid them, but kind of a very healing and transformative space where we can listen to each other more and also like speak up to give a voice to everybody. So kind of, again, community building. It was through art. So art becomes a tool for understanding each other.
That sounds really powerful to create a space for that. That show that you organized and where Tome also took part in, it sounded so great. And I wish it could have been moved around and shown in different locations and gotten more visibility, right? But that is the key, is to start in our own communities and then go outwards. And when it grows organically like that, it's wonderful. I'm curious about this model minority myth and how, Pallavi, you feel that it may have harmed our community.
Most definitely. Oh my God. Yeah, I teach Asian American narratives class in at CCA in Critical Ethnic Studies program. As you said, it's a myth which government and media started perpetuating during Cold War to point out how Asian American communities are model minority citizens who are portrayed as smarter and more successful than other minority groups, such as African Americans who are portrayed not doing so well. This narrative, the whole narrative, kind of harms not only African Americans, but also Asian Americans. It creates a wedge between them. And also, it ignores the racial violence and discrimination what Black Americans have faced in this country. It suggests that Black Americans could be just as successful as Asian Americans if they were law-abiding, peace-loving, courteous people living quietly in the society. Secondly, it's also harmful to Asian American community who are not doing so well. As an example, if you see the statistics, many Asian American communities are financially lagging behind. They face poverty. Model minority myth lumps all Asian into one, a group and portrays them as a monolith, which ignores, again, intra-ethnic diversity. I think we need to understand that there is a great educational, linguistic, cultural variability which Asian American community holds. When we talk about model minority myth, we overlook all the problems which impacts adversely, Asian American community. We need to understand that when we talk about Asian American community, it entails ethnic groups from more than 40 countries, I believe. Making them homogeneous is to deny their identity, to ignore problems specific to their communities. These groups do not receive any kind of help and support which they need and deserve. Also, we know that any kind of social stratification can impact individual lives. The sheer pressure to fill the mold, to live up to the mark, can create social pressures and can impact the mental well-being of individuals and also create stigma to not to talk about it. For example, that all Asian American youth are high achievers prevent some from receiving necessary resource and support, particularly within the academic setting. This can cause great psychological distress. I have seen this firsthand during my career, teaching in academia.
Well, I was just thinking, Pamela, when I mentioned Vincent Chen, and the one paragraph that I want to reference is, in 1982, the senseless murder of Vincent Chen while doing what would have furthered his life journey by getting married. Okay, he was going to celebrate with somebody. A few white men mistook him for Japanese. Now, this is 1982 that this happened. And the Japanese war had not just ended then. It had happened long ago. And yet the hatred that people would harbor for years and years and years after certain things have happened and not rationalize what they were about to do. I think that's the most heinous thing that a human being could do to another human being. That because you think that somebody is something, as Pallavi said, you talk about one particular group of people, but if you say Muslim, that doesn't, you're embracing a whole lot of different cultures, a whole lot of different people from a lot of different countries. And people are so limited, or allow themselves to be so limited in their scope, that they would harbor ill will for something that makes no sense. And here's this man who's going to get married, and they kill him, and they get off, you know, they get a small fine and they get off. And it just reminded me of the Black Lives Movement and Black Lives Matter, because it's nothing new. It's just the interesting thing when I mentioned social media and cell phones. If it wasn't for cell phones, it would still be things going on like this that would be hidden. We now have practically every other person having a cell phone that can whip it out and take a video. And that has been a saving grace for a lot of people. And that shouldn't be. It just should not be. But it is fortunately existing. And it has created not only Black Lives Matter, but you have Asians for Black Lives. You have different groups who are grouping together, and they're making a point of, we need to stay in solidarity and change the mindset of a lot of people. It's not just one person. We have one person in a country who decided that he wanted to take over another country. This is happening right now. One person. But that one person would not have been successful if the other people who got into the tanks, the trucks, the airplanes, and said, no, we're not going to do this. So unfortunately, we have a lot of people's minds that we have to change. And that's Pallavi said it very well. It's not lumping everybody together and saying, oh yeah, the model citizen. If you're going to say someone's a model citizen as a person of color, is the Asians, because there's Korean, Japanese, all these different countries all jammed up together and called Asian Americans, you know, and they're not all the same. They don't act all the same. They don't look all the same. There's a lot of education that has to be done, and our visual artists, one powerful way of doing it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I often think about when I lived in Hawaii, just learning the history of how when those workers on the plantations, they would divide up the groups of people, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, that's how they maintained their power. Yeah. And then they created this Hawaiian Pidgin English language that kind of united them, and they could communicate together. And that's when their lives began to be able to improve, because they worked together. It's just so obvious. And yet with having that knowledge and then putting it into practice, you know, and working towards that goal is really important. And so I think about the police reform versus like defunding the police. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious what your thoughts on this topic are.
For me, there needs to be a level of defunding, because anytime you have a city, and I'll use Oakland as an example, since I worked for the city of Oakland for years, if a city has 80% of its budget going towards one entity, which is the police department, there is something wrong with that. I mean, you might as well say it's a police state. If you have 80% of your budget going to one entity, and that entity happens to be the so-called security of a people, what does that say? And I have always found that a very hard swallow. There is the need to drop that somewhat. I'm not saying they should be totally like no money. Obviously, we need police, because I was just looking at, this is going to be an aside, but I was just looking at a Netflix, because I only subscribe to one streaming. I don't have a lot of money. I don't want to spend a lot of money supporting companies. So I have Netflix, and I was watching a movie, and the guy even said, why is it that people, when something happens, the first thing they think about is calling 911 and the police? And yes, naturally, if you're in a situation where you feel like you're threatened, who are you going to call? The police. So I'm not saying that we should not have police. We have some horrible, horrible people existing amongst us. But what I'm suggesting is that where we can alleviate some of what we know is going to be ongoing situations with people who are either born with situations that they can't handle, and they stress out and conk out and do things that they don't deliberately want to do, then we need social services to take care of that. If we perpetuate war like we keep doing, and I'm saying we globally, people are going to come back warped. You can't watch that kind of scenario and come back and still be a whole person. So they need social services. There's so many other situations that we're perpetuating. We've got men that go to jail, and men, as people know, men have a difficulty with with not wanting to let themselves go as far as sexually or whatever. And it seems like it's an off topic, but if you put men with men, they have to have a release. So we're creating a situation that doesn't make sense to put a whole bunch of men together, and we don't really consider what natural outcomes are going to happen. So then you have men coming out of that situation and they need help because they were more or less, they couldn't afford a lawyer, or they did a petty job, but they got some ridiculous something as far as their guilt put on them. And they spend more time in jail than normal, and or prison than normal for that particular crime. So they come out and they're warped. So we have all these different situations that we're creating that is not in line with what should be a humane and just type of community. And we're aggravating it by having the police be the ones to supposedly take care of it. When they can't take care of it, that's not their job, you know. So that's my thing about the funding the police.
And I do feel the same, that we do need not only to reform, but restructure and relocate funds to the community-based organization, agencies who have deeper understanding of the problems and who deal with people with more kindness and love. I don't have expertise in this, but I do see viability and importance of it. Maybe like, interracial solidarity, restorative justice, like, you know, the groups who are geared towards that, they can be of great help in another kind of structure, which is not so much, you know, so much white-centered.
If those resources are used in other ways, right, then you create much more support for the citizens and creating jobs and housing and healthcare. Like, it just, everything gets better, and then the crises can decrease, right? I feel like it's continually using the failed system that just keeps not working. Right. Both of you have this history together, and I think it's wonderful that you have this continued friendship and you work together making art and doing shows. Where else do you see in our communities, like directly or even at large, where there are Black and Asian communities coming together?
It's very similar to what Paul of you was saying. There's lots of organizations who are making an effort to cross the border, you know, just like collaborate and understand that the Asian Cultural Center reaches out and does various things with various communities. So there's different Hispanic and Latin places like the Eastside Alliance who are working and reaching out and understanding that we need to not just be aware of our own, because it's now almost in the face of anybody who is conscientious as far as community organizations. There's a lot of cross collaboration going on right now. You know, if it's a Latino group, they're doing Latina and something else, some other obvious different culture, and mixing it up. You know, it's needed, because we're living in these silos. And it allows for you to think that these things are only affecting your group, but they're not. What's happened with Asians is when Asians started migrating over here, the government was not kind to them either. I mean, it's a horrible history. It's not just Blacks. It's just terrible. And some people are trying to make a point of rectifying it, thankfully, in the political arena, but it's happening very slowly. There's not enough being done soon enough, so that we have these things that are happening where if people had been very attentive, what's happening with Ukraine and Russia would have never happened. You know, that's just unconscionable. We should have learned our lesson. But the unfortunate thing that as I grow older, I'm realizing it's like it takes 3 decades for a baby to become what is considered an adult. That means that every third decade is being repeated because of that. Because that child, as they grew up and became an adult, depending on where they are with regard to if they want knowledge or not and where they want to seek their knowledge, they will either be dependent on their immediate family, and that means passed down stories and activities and whatever of that family. So if you have a family that's racist and that's where that child is getting their arc of knowledge, then you've perpetuated it. It's not going to change. Because once somebody's 30, it's very difficult to switch unless they consciously decide to do it. outside forces are really hard to penetrate. It's like taking a hose with a spring of water just coming gently out and hitting a rock. It's just lightly touching the rock. It's not going to penetrate the rock. The rock has to decide it's going to move or relocate or whatever, and or allow itself to break down and that kind of thing. That's why we always see these cyclical situations. We're having new people come aboard, and depending on where they are getting their information from, it really colors their thought. It's a very interesting process. And I think that as you get older and you can spend more time thinking about things as opposed to when you're younger and you're just out there doing stuff, it really makes a difference of what conclusions that you come to.
To me, it's also an everyday learning and practice to create deep connections in the neighborhood. In our backyard, along the historic moment which has happened in the past, which shook and impacted, and at times overturned the racist policies which barred Asian Americans, immigrants coming to this country. Many of such facts are overlooked and not remembered by the mainstream media and policymakers and government because it's not beneficial for them. I would love to hear more such stories which can heal the wounds and bring both the communities together. You know, during the pandemic, we saw the trope of Black and Asian conflict was, it reignited. So fortunately, we are seeing more and more Asian American collectives, orgs, working and supporting each other, coming in solidarity with each other and setting aside their differences. And most importantly, also working to understand the history and the systems of inequality that positioned them there in the first place.
This podcast was produced with support from the Ginkgo Fund, the Asian Pacific Fund, and the Awesome Foundation. Special thanks to Jay Lin for recording and editing this episode. Want to suggest future guests? Email us at programs@oacc.cc.